Alvarado, Mr. Bonnet,
May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Eric Bonnet, and I'm here representing the defendant, appellant Ramon Alvarado, Jr. Your Honors, my client is entitled to a remand for resentencing because the trial court used the wrong standard for determining his sentence on revocation of supervised release, or at the very least failed to provide the record discussion that would give the court the confidence it needs to affirm the sentence. This case's guideline court's sentencing cases routinely say you start with the guidelines. The guidelines are not mentioned at all by the judge in the in his explanation of sentence. Instead, the guidelines, by the way, provided for a 7 to 13 month sentence. He was given a 24 month sentence. And there's no discussion of what the guideline sentence, was, why he's going over, not even an acknowledgement that he's going above. What was that?
Pretty obvious. Rampant violations of probation, real wise guy.
Well, he has...
Certainly not an unreasonable sentence. I mean, that doesn't really affect your argument, but...
It doesn't, Your Honor. Could the court have given was the 24-month within reasonable? It may well have been. But there's a procedure for going about doing that. There's standards that this court and Congress have set, and those weren't done. There's no acknowledgement of the guidelines.
But both sides had agreed that the range was 7 to 13 months, didn't they?
Oh, that's correct.
And the probation officer had provided that in a written form to the judge?
Certainly the judge... there's reason to think the judge was aware, but it wasn't acknowledged in the discussion of sentencing.
The judge seemed to focus on the good deal that your client got at the original sentence.
Yes, I think the focus was very heavily on that. Almost very little discussion of the revocation itself or the offenses. I think there were about a two-paragraph description of that. Didn't even mention some of the counts that have been raised. As this court said in the Robertson case, these are federal judges. We normally expect them to know things like what the guideline sentences is, but you can't assume that if it's not in the record. He may have done it right and just didn't say it, but
counsel,
we can't assume
that.
Counsel,
you're focusing on your weakest argument here, which I find mystifying. The strongest argument that you have is on the round of revocation that the judge adjudicated without a real factual basis, which is this obstructing, resisting offense. So perhaps you could direct your attention to that.
Well, I think the court, I think that was very weak evidence on that. I think the evidence for you know, for that charge was that he had, I think he had hung up on an officer, basically, and perhaps used some choice words in doing it, which...
Right, that's not
really
resisting under Wisconsin law. That's my point.
I think that's right. I guess I haven't focused on it because, I mean, the judge didn't really focus on those. There were other grounds.
Did the judge determine whether your client had actually violated that condition of release?
He said, he gave a one sentence that he found him guilty on all seven counts. I'm trying to remember whether that was one of the ones he gave a follow-up sentence on or not.
He didn't say anything about it.
I don't think he mentioned that one in any depth. And, I mean, there were several that weren't mentioned at all by the judge. And, you know, they were contested.
Do you contend there was insufficient evidence to show that obstruction violation?
I guess this kind of, you know, segues back into the prior. You know, there's no discussion of these offenses, so, you know, I don't know whether he got the legal standard wrong, whether he made factual errors. It's the discussion's not there. You know, I don't think there was evidence to, you know, to support, you know, that finding.
So let's take that out of the mix. Was there enough any other violations to support the sentence?
Well, there were other violations. I think one that he did discuss was getting kicked out of the. I think it was a drug treatment program. You know, he'd had some disruptive behavior with that. There was failing to report a police contact, you know, which the court said, well, you got to know that, you know, you're on supervised release. You need to report these things. I think those were the two that he actually mentioned, you know, that the court followed up on a little bit. There was also he had been found in the presence of a felon, although there wasn't really evidence that he knew that. It was, you know, he explained it was a friend of a friend. He had been found. They have found some drugs in his residence, which I don't believe was really discussed in the record. You know.
So is it your position that the other six violations are insufficient to support the sentence that was given? Or what exactly is your position on that?
Well, I guess again, we don't know what the court's reasoning was. The court's reasoning starts with, you know, well, I gave you a break last time, and I can't give you that again. I've got to go with what the prosecution said. You know, there's no discussion of the guidelines. I mean, going through the, you know, the seven factors or six sentencing factors, you know, the nature and circumstance of the offense, well, several of them he didn't even mention. The history and characteristics of the defendant covered in, you know, a fair amount of detail. The need to deter future crime, protect the public, provide the defendant, etc. Maybe you could argue he touched on that.
Isn't it apparent that he's going to impose the same sentence? Because he says, can I give you another break? No. I mean, that makes the system just meaningless if I do that. And that's a perfectly defensible view. And that's what he's going to do.
He might, Your Honor.
What would make him not?
Well, if he goes through the proper procedure and starts, okay, the guidelines suggest...
But he doesn't have to pay any attention. All he has to do is consider the guidelines. And he can say, I don't agree with the guidelines. I must say that 9 to 13 months seems really a meager sanction for this person who's totally out of control.
Yeah, and he might.
Actually, it's no favor to him to give him a break.
The trial court judge may well decide that if we go back to resentencing, but.
So what's the point?
He needs to do that.
What's the point?
Well, he might do that. He might not do that.
It's no favor to this guy to get at just 9 months, right? He'll figure he beat the system and go back to his criminal career.
Again, that's a decision the trial court judge can consider. But, you know, he's supposed to start with the guidelines, and he didn't give an indication that he was doing that. And he put all the weight on the factor of he got a break last time. Let's see.
Thank you, Mr.
Light
Allen.
Is going up. I think
Mr. Bonnet, thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Koenig?
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States this morning. My opponent has all but conceded that a 24-month sentence is reasonable, so unless the Court has questions on that, I'll address the procedural arguments in his brief. He never really directly answered Judge Sykes's question whether, you know, if 6 of the 7 violations were established, would the sentence be justified? And I will concede that the conduct of telling an officer to flip off over the telephone does not satisfy the elements of resisting and obstructing in the state of Wisconsin. But if you take that out of the mix, you still have a very serious set of violations and clearly an attitudinal problem on the part of this defendant. Now, what does it mean to consider the guidelines? Judge Randa did not, in this case, say, I find that your range is 7 to 13 months, and I'm not going to give you that sentence because.
7? It wasn't? Was it 7 to 13?
I thought it was 7 to 13.
I thought it was 9, but.
I apologize if I misspoke.
Remarkable.
But what he did do, as Judge Tinder noted, the range was set forth in the PSR. It was also acknowledged during the hearing by defense counsel as being correct. And the judge did begin the hearing by saying that I have to consider the guidelines that are and always have been guidelines and integrating them now into, of course, the factors under 3553A.
Well, he even gave them more weight than they deserved, didn't he? Because in the range of supervised release, they never were guidelines. They're just policy statements, aren't they?
That's actually true, Your Honor.
So he gave them a little more weight than, or at least in that statement, attributed more weight than they deserved.
That's right. So he acknowledges the dual sources of authority right at the beginning of the hearing, and then I think he gives a pretty thorough explanation under the 3553A factors of why this guy deserves a 24-month sentence. And given the substantial overlap between the guidelines and the statute, I don't really see that he ought to have done a great deal more.
Is it inappropriate to consider the break that was given at the initial sentencing in evaluating a supervised release violation?
Not at all, Your Honor. I would argue that comment 4 to section 7B1.4 directly supports Judge Randa's approach, which was to say, hey, you got a real break in the underlying case. I took a gamble on you. And it's clear that the judge was somewhat invested in this particular defendant. He wanted him to succeed. He was very reluctant about imposing a 24-month sentence. I'm very disappointed that the defendant had not sort of
justified that confidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, had Judge Randa given the defendant 7 months, for example, he could have extended the supervised release period another 36 months, and then if another violation occurred, given a larger period of time, could have accumulated 24 months over the process.
I think the judgment in this case is that further release would be throwing good money after bad, and it was not worth it for this particular individual.
But
again,
the government,
not unreasonable.
Did the government say this 7 to 13 or 9 to 13 was adequate?
We argued, Your Honor, for the statutory maximum of 24 months.
You did argue for the 24 months?
Yes.
Well, part of what seemed to weigh heavily in the judge's calculus here was the fact that all of these violations were committed in a 2-month period, after the defendant's release, and he had been before this judge just a couple of years before on the underlying offense, and so the speed with which he flamed out on supervised release was pretty astonishing. At least that's what comes through pretty clearly from the judge's remarks.
The other thing that strikes me about the judge's remarks in this case is that he was obviously quite familiar with the defendant, his history in the underlying case, his performance on pretrial release in the underlying case. And he talked about all of those things, and also the fact that he turned around rather quickly after being released from prison and started, having tantrums in his group therapy session and mouthing off to the police and being found with 8 baggies of cocaine and being testing positive for drug use and all the other
violations. Wasn't there a cocaine result after the third marijuana test that he flunked, and he made some statement about, well, I knew I'd flunked the earlier test, so I was just going to go out with a bang or something like that?
I think that was in reference to marijuana use, not cocaine use. Again, there were 8 bags of cocaine found in his, one-bedroom residence that he shared with his mother. And I believe the cocaine positive came back shortly after that.
How long has he been in jail now?
I'm not sure. He got 48 months. And as Judge Sykes noted, these violations started piling up very quickly. So altogether, if you add the 24 months to the underlying sentence, you're still below the advisory guideline range on the underlying crime.
I'm just wondering, because his lawyer mentioned at the sentencing hearing that he'd already been in jail for 4 months. And I just wondered what it's now. I mean, won't the 24 months be up pretty quickly before there could be a resentencing?
I'm not sure. I argued one of these cases last week, and it was a 6-month sentence, and that was obviously much more compressed. I would think that the court has time to provide relief.
What was the date of the sentencing hearing, roughly?
Sorry, I dropped some materials on the floor.
May 11th?
Sounds right, of last year.
Oh, I see. So it's about 12 months now. And he'd been in for 16 months, actually only 8 months. So if we remanded and the judge immediately didn't have an immediate hearing, the 24 months might have run.
Well, as some of the questioning indicated previously, there's no reason to suppose on this record that the outcome would be any different if the court were to send it back and insist on more explicit factual findings or a greater exposition of the guidelines, why they don't apply here. So unless there are further questions, I would ask you to affirm.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Koenig. Mr. Bonnet, how much time? You don't have any time, but you can have a minute. Also, isn't this rapidly becoming academic? So hasn't he been in jail for 16 months now?
No, Your Honor. Assuming that my statement of the case is accurate, which I hope it is, Warren was arrested on April 4th of last year, and the sentencing hearing was held on August 2nd, which I think is 4 months. So.
Okay, so he was arrested in April, so it's only 12 or 13 months.
Right. So if, if he remanded and he, the judge decided, well, let's go at the top of the guideline range, probably he would be released right immediately after the sentencing hearing, assuming that it would take more than 3 weeks to do that. The other two points I want to make are that, one, I think the error in finding obstruction does color the rest of the proceedings. The court has said in some other similar cases, that when you've got one error like this, that just casts more doubt when there's non-explanation.
What does it cast doubt?
Which case was that?
I didn't hear what you said.
Well, that there's a, because, you know, you got this finding of the obstruction of justice, and you just got this very cursory, I find him guilty on all seven counts. I think that casts some doubt as to whether, you know, he really went through the proper analysis, especially since he doesn't detail that.
Is there any reason to think that the other violations, the other six, were improperly adjudicated, that there was not a factual basis for them?
I think some of them were fairly clear. Some of them were kind of iffy. There were...
Well, you didn't attack
disputes.
Any of the others.
I didn't attack them because the court didn't... I mean, the trial court didn't focus on those in his sentencing. I mean, clearly, the big factor that he looked at was, you know, I gave you a break last time. And that certainly is a factor, but it's not the only factor that's supposed to be looked at, and especially when you're sentencing at the maximum, which this court has noted raises problems with the the uniformity of sentencing, that the maximum should
it's 24
be fairly
months,
unusual.
It's not life in prison.
Well, that's what this court said in Snyder, which was also a revocation case. I don't think that was much longer sentence than this one.
But he's still well below the original guidelines range.
Well, if you look back at the original underlying count, yes, that's true. But as a revocation violation, he's above the guidelines and at the statutory maximum.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bonnet. And Mr. Koenig, you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf
of the
Your Honor. We thank Mr. Koenig as well.